because we care. We ask all the questions that others don't dare. We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.
So welcome to Dads on the Air for Tuesday, the 30th of June, 2009. Should be an interesting show. We're calling it the Barbara Biggs Show. Barbara Biggs has become the new poster girl for the anti-shared parenting movement, and we'll be playing an interview with her and various questions that were asked of her. We'll be going through all that. You can listen to all this later at www.dadsontheair.net, and you can also listen to it via live streaming on the 2GLF website.
John, as you were saying, Barbara Biggs has become the new poster girl for the anti-shared parenting movement. While many fathers have been disturbed by her comments in the media recently against shared and cooperative parenting after divorce, today we're going to play the first opportunity for many, including listeners to our show, to actually hear what she has to say directly and unfiltered by the lens of journalists and the other media. So Barbara Biggs spoke last week at a fellowship of the Round Table Forum at New South Wales Parliament House, and the subject of that forum was Family Law: Is the Man the Loser? This week, we're going to broadcast the speech that she gave, followed by her answers to questions from the floor. Family law reformers around the country have been alarmed at the scurrilous campaign, including a number of demonstrations outside family courts and other locations, to return family law to the dark ages, where more than half of all children entering the family court arena rarely, if ever, saw their fathers again, and almost no fathers were ever given any substantial time with their children. The best a father could expect was a couple of hours or perhaps a day every 2 weeks. The campaign that's currently being undertaken is being conducted under the guise of preventing domestic violence against women and sexual abuse against children, something that we at Dads on the Air would absolutely support. However, Biggs claims that the shared parenting laws have forced children to spend time with abusive parents, but her target is clearly fathers and not just all abusive parents. One simple point that reformers make is that child abuse is actually committed by both genders and is a crime. It's a police matter, but Biggs only focuses on sexual abuse of children, and she ignores homicide, infanticide, neglect, emotional and physical abuse. And in all these categories, women make up the majority of perpetrators. But surprisingly, on all Biggs's material and all of her spouting off in the media, none of these issues are ever raised. Most sexual abuse of children actually occurs at the hands of other siblings, step-parents, mothers' boyfriends or de factos, and other relatives. Fathers, as a group, are the least likely to sexually abuse their children. For the vast majority of family law cases, the research is very clear. Children benefit from a continued relationship with both parents after separation, and the small reforms that the Howard government introduced in this regard, or moving in this direction, will obviously benefit the vast majority of parents and children. Barbara Biggs has made a career out of her colourful life, including alleging she was sold as a sex slave by her grandmother at 14, as well as doing stints as a prostitute, a mental health patient and property developer. Her books include In Moral Danger, The Journey Home, The Accidental Renovator, and Money and Sex, How to Get More. Whether Biggs is a dangerous hysteric promoting irrational hatred against men and fathers, or whether she's a true champion of the nation's abused children, you can decide for yourself. Surprisingly, Barbara Biggs said at the forum that the Child Support Agency should be abolished, as it causes more trouble than it's worth. I'm sure most fathers and non-custodial mothers would agree. As well, interesting for a feminist advocate, she claims that about 30% of all child sexual abuse cases are perpetrated by women. That's something that we at Dads on the Air have known for quite some time. At last we have a leading feminist figure admitting that abuse is actually perpetrated by both genders. Ms. Biggs claimed that she wanted to work with fathers and fathers' groups in her campaign for safer family law. But within 24 hours, the most virulent of the anti-father websites, a site called Anonymums, and the URL for that is anonymum, that's anonymum.bravehost.com. That website, with which Biggs appears to be closely linked, was frothing at the mouth that men would dare speak at Parliament, and inviting readers of the website to click on a link to the song which played Who Let the Dogs Out. May we gently suggest that if you really want to work with fathers, the first step might be not to call them dogs. And if Biggs isn't associated with that website, and if she does genuinely want to work with fathers, it might be good for her to contact that website and let them know that she doesn't support calling fathers dogs. Many of Biggs's critics are concerned about the anti-male tone which permeates her work and the hatred displayed in her campaigning. Here's a sample from her book called In Moral Danger. I quote, "I'm still staring guys back, but I can't help buying into what I know is in their heads about me. I'm trying to assert myself on behalf of women, but when I see the look in their eyes and the whole thing ... with my head, the more I have to look away, the worse I feel. Then I start noticing how guys sit on the bus with their legs wide apart like they own the place, when we women are all squished up, being polite, making room for other passengers. The more I hate guys for taking up so much space in the world, the more I hate myself for being such a worm about not meeting their eyes in the street." We'll be back with the Barbara Biggs speech and questions after this track.
Our children are stolen, my stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. Caught in a trap, they must learn to survive, so they join with their parent who hates, cheats and lies. After a while, they both act the same, the brainwashing parent and a child without shame. A child is not born with hate in their heart. It's taught in a household where parents live apart. The parents they live with use fear and control to brainwash their children since the court gave them this role. Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. The child does not know when deception occurs. They're too young to recognize denigration and slurs. To hate the other parent is rewarded with praise. They're not free to think as they're locked in a cage. Surely it's abuse when misbehavior persists. Their childhood destroyed by these parental terrorists. Dysfunctional thoughts can make them angry or depressed. Inflicted by these parents who are sick and obsessed. Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. One day the child will seek out the past. Faced with the truth, it will leave them aghast. They will discover how lies changed their life, how helpless they were and how lucky to survive. To all who take part or do nothing to prevent this abuse of our children,
who continued to lament the loss of a parent when they are growing up. You will stand condemned as weak and corrupt. Our children are stolen by stealth and deceit, by brainwashing parents who charm, lie and cheat. They're soon taught to hate a parent they once loved. Our poor little children, enough is enough. We're back with Dad's on the Air.
Now the last speaker in our lineup will be Barbara Biggs. Now Barbara Biggs has come at very short notice to replace Catherine Swinburne, and as I said earlier, we're deeply appreciative of that, Barbara. Barbara is a journalist and convener of National Council for Children Post-Separation. She's also the author of a couple of very interesting books. Sorry, that's what microphones are like. Very interesting books entitled The Road Home and In Moral Danger, published recently, and I do believe that copies are available on the back table. Now I'll just read from the back cover of one of these two books, The Road Home. At 14, she was sold to a barrister and sexual predator. At 16, she admitted herself to a psychiatric hospital. At 18, she escaped Cambodia as it fell to the Khmer Rouge. At 19, she was a prostitute in Japan. At 21, she got death threats and made national headlines. And it goes on at the bottom. 22, she became a mother. 25, a classical pianist. At 30, a journalist. At 40, a property millionaire. And finally, she confronts her past and the man who almost destroyed her and wins. That in itself would be a fascinating story that could fill a couple of forums on its own. I'd like you to welcome Barbara Biggs, please.
Thanks to the organisers for organising this event. It was a very hastily written speech this afternoon. The topic that is the father the loser in family law? I think I agree with everyone here that it's a very controversial topic. I think it would have been better to ask, is the child the loser? And I think everybody here agrees that the child is and has been the loser. Now, just so you can concentrate on what I'm saying and not my glasses, these are magnets. Some of you in the audience may wonder how it came about on this important issue that there's only one woman and all these guys sitting at the table on a topic that so seriously impacts on children. The organisers had hoped for a more balanced view, but because of what I believe are the inherent disadvantages and inequalities of women in our society, it turned out that once again, the interests of men are being represented more fully than those of women and children. I've looked at the forum site of some of the men's rights groups represented here today and found a disturbing element of anger, control and hatred of women. The word feminist is used as if it means liar, man-hater or hysterical female. I'd like to say, and make no apologies for it, that I am a feminist. This doesn't mean I'm hysterical, but that I seek to redress the inequalities women face regarding income levels and representation in government and public life. I don't think anybody could dispute that. Nor does it mean I hate men. I love men. How could I not? My 29-year-old son is a man. What I do abhor and seek to also address tonight is the power violent and controlling people have over small, vulnerable and innocent children. While we all agree that shared parenting is the ideal in an ideal world, the facts are that the latest research shows that where there is entrenched conflict, shared parenting puts too great a burden on children of the partnership. Those who know the family court list will also know that the cases which end up there are those which involve the highest level of entrenched conflict. Under the current shared parenting law, what we do know, which is there for all to see on the Family Court website, is that parents the court itself has deemed abusive and violent are still awarded access to their children. In cases where less than 30% care was awarded to fathers, in 29% of those cases, this was because, and I quote, abuse and family violence. When mothers were awarded less than 30% care, this was the reason in 16% of cases. This means that in litigated family court cases in 2007 and 8, 267 fathers and mothers were awarded some care of their children even though the court deemed them to be violent. Extrapolating from that, given that the Federal Magistrate Court deals with 97% of cases, there are 2.16 children per household, and this covers just 1 year, we estimate there are at the very least 15,000 Australian children being forced to have ongoing contact with a parent the courts have said are violent and abusive. Some of these contact visits are supervised. Why, I would like to ask, are abusive parents being subsidised to the tune of $180 an hour by you and me, the taxpayer, to be given the opportunity to terrorise their child for an hour or more a week? As one grandmother wrote to us, my grandchildren told the court psychologist how they had to watch their father bash their mother, spit on her, drag her around by the hair, and kick her with steel-toed boots just after she'd given birth. And then the court said to go and sit at the contact office and have a meaningful access visit. If a parent cannot be trusted to be with a child without supervision, they should be ordered by the court to attend parenting courses, anger management, or some other treatment to address their behaviour. The Safer Family Law Campaign has tried hard to keep all our language gender neutral. We have invited the men's rights groups, many of you here today, to attend our rallies with us. We want your help in trying to protect children from violence and abuse. My emails have gone unacknowledged. Yet I find it difficult to believe that you don't share my concerns about the physical safety and psychological and emotional well-being of your children. However, reading some of the forum comments on your websites, I can see that many of your members are damaged. So many of us have been damaged from our own abusive and neglectful childhoods, myself included. I fully support anyone in their attempts to address these issues in their lives and heal from their own violence and abuse. But these issues need to be acknowledged to be addressed. Disseminating hate and supporting members of your groups who have these anger issues does nothing to help them or their children. In fact, it only further damages both. Instead of addressing abusive behaviour, many of the men's rights groups have been able to disseminate, without credible supporting evidence, that most allegations of abuse in custody proceedings are false. There is much peer-reviewed evidence, which I'm happy to send anyone who puts their name on a sheet at the back of the room, that more than 90% of allegations of abuse in custody cases are true. We have a sample of 6 studies. However, one is an Australian study by Professor Thea Brown from Monash University Social Work and Human Services. Results of this study showed that abuse in Australian family court cases was real, that it was severe and serious, and the courts and child protection services did not provide services for the families. Another study from the University of Toronto in 2004. Results of this analysis show that neglect is the most common form of intentionally fabricated maltreatment, while anonymous reporters and non-custodial parents, usually fathers, most frequently prompt intentionally false reports. Of the intentionally false allegations of maltreatment tracked, custodial parents, usually mothers, and victimised children were least likely to fabricate reports of abuse or neglect. This is the most important and thorough research testing done on this issue. Men's rights counter that they were biased in their approach. These two researchers are academically qualified men who are well respected in their fields, as demonstrated by the peer-reviewed publication of their findings, revealing the existence of child abuse in the context of marital breakdown and custody and access disputes. And yet, because groups representing men have had the ear of the media for the past 15 years, a recent public survey, which I think one of you mentioned, perhaps you, Mark, indicated that when asked if allegations of abuse in custody cases was false, 49% of the public said yes, and 25% said they were not sure. This means that 75% of the public are prepared to believe that most allegations of abuse in custody cases are false, which is completely contrary to all the research. This is what led to the shared parenting amendments, which the Chief Justice of the Family Court said in a letter to the Attorney General in early May, when we held our national rallies, that the amendments discouraged parents from raising allegations of abuse, and that urgent changes were needed to the Act to address this problem. So the 15,000 children forced into contact with abusive parents mentioned above is only the tip of the iceberg. It represents only those deemed by the court to be violent. Then there are all those who were told by their lawyers not to raise allegations of abuse. I've seen photographs of welts on a four-year-old girl's back, which one of our parents showed her solicitor, only to be told that it would be unwise to produce this in court. Why not? Asked the mother incredulously. Because you will risk losing your child if you do, was his reply. The photographs remain in a drawer. If parents do raise allegations of abuse and can't prove it to the satisfaction of the court, sexual abuse in particular, but even violence, is extremely difficult to prove. They must pay both costs and risk losing custody of their child. That's enough to scare most parents off, even raising the allegations. They will be seen as not promoting contact with the other parent. I ask you in the audience to put yourselves for a moment in the position of having seen abuse and violence and being forced by law to promote a healthy and positive relationship with that person. I saw the mother of the child mentioned above with the welts tell her daughter the morning her weekly two-day access visit was about to happen. You'll have a lovely time with Daddy. Jack's going to be there and Daddy has a surprise for you. She said this in an excited voice to counter the distress of her daughter at that time. As she was putting the clothes on the little girl to get her ready for access, as fast as she put them on, the little girl was taking them off, hysterically crying and begging not to go on the access visit. Yet she's forced by law to try and promote it as a happy event. This father has not been physically violent to the mother. However, on his two-day access visits, he expects his four-year-old daughter to do and enjoy life as he does. He takes her to nighttime football matches in the middle of winter, makes her eat hot curry because he likes it, makes her watch Underbelly even though it distresses her. He punishes her when she doesn't enjoy the tastes of his 45-year-old male tastes. He has mild Asperger's and is unable to sympathise with his daughter's distress. And that's only about violence. Child sexual abuse is another difficulty altogether. Often children only feel safe to reveal sexual abuse once they are not living with the perpetrator. Disclosures often come upon separation. Many abusers threaten children with the most dreadful things like, I'll kill your mother, or I'll kill your pet, or I'll kill you if you tell. If a parent believes their child, and we have both mothers and fathers in this situation, they are in a double bind. If they have no evidence, they are not believed, and they are labelled alienating parents and lose custody. If they try to produce evidence by taping conversations, photographing genital bruising or damage, take their child to a therapist, reporting to docs, they are labelled neurotic. Most child sexual abuse is perpetrated by men, but some research indicates, and I believe this, that up to 30% of sexual abuse, child sexual abuse, is by women. Mothers, babysitters, sisters, aunts, neighbours. However, when a child discloses abuse, if it is not the mother, the child is most likely to disclose to her. Again, according to the Family Court website statistics, when mothers were given less than 30% care, the most common reason in 31% of cases, mental health was the reason. Yet only 3% of men awarded less than 30% care had mental health issues. How can this be? Although in the general population women do have a higher percentage of mental health problems than men, it is nothing like 10 times higher as the family court statistics would have us believe. What we are seeing is that while parental alienation syndrome, or PAS, is no longer allowed as a defence in the family court proceedings, the thinking still infects the court culture. PAS was the notion of an American paedophile psychologist who self-published his own book of that name and went around teaching auditoriums full of lawyers in there how to get their clients off child sexual abuse cases. You simply accuse the other parent of having a mental illness called PAS. Bingo! The alleged perpetrator gets full custody and the protective parent gets only supervised access visits. This is happening all over Australia. This syndrome was then exported to other English-speaking countries. Excuse me, we've had an hour and a half of men speaking. I have 20 minutes. I'd appreciate silence during my speech. This syndrome was then exported to other English-speaking countries. The premise was that most allegations of abuse in custody matters are false, despite an avalanche of evidence to the contrary. Although it's no longer allowed as a defence and the word syndrome is no longer used, it's been replaced by other words such as no contact parent, alienating, unfriendly, or hostile parent. And if you are one of these, you have a mental health issue. We believe this is what accounts for the extraordinarily high level of mothers with mental health issues in litigated family court cases. One of the things the Safer Family Law campaign is hoping to see changed is the introduction of risk assessments on a scale of 1 to 10. This is the brainchild of former family court judge Tim Carmody, who resigned last year because he couldn't work under the current shared parenting laws. He didn't feel he could keep children safe operating under those amendments. He said that shared parenting should be the end point, not the starting point of family law. If all is well and good, parents are cooperating and friendly, by all means, reward them with shared parenting. But where parents have separated because of violence or entrenched conflict, forcing them to co-parent is like forcing them into a socially engineered partnership that does not work for either party and certainly works least of all for the child. We suggest a panel of people, some of whom know the child well, to provide a risk assessment and recommendation to the court. This could involve the child's teacher or childcare worker, since the child spends most of the day with that person. It could also involve a police officer, the child's psychologist or therapist if they have one, a social worker, a medical practitioner. One of the other systemic problems we're finding is that family court experts, who alone currently make recommendations to the court, are often not trained in domestic violence or child sexual abuse, which make up the bulk of cases in the family court. And yet they are determining if a child is the subject of either one or both. Sometimes these experts only speak to the parents and or child for 15 minutes. I've heard of cases where they've spoken to them on the phone and where they haven't spoken to them at all. Most see the parties only once. Children who are being sexually abused have usually been threatened into silence. They may take up to 6 sessions to disclose. A child who's being coached will not be consistent and will reveal immediately in a language inappropriate to their age. People trained in child sexual abuse will, over several sessions, be able to determine if the abuse is happening or not. We would also like to see all those in family court have specific training in domestic violence and child sexual abuse, since this makes up the bulk of the cases. In Victoria, laws adopted in December last year included a range of domestic violence tactics in the new legislation. These included isolating a partner from family and friends, financial abuse, as well as consistent belittling of one's partner. All these behaviours negatively impact on children and should be considered in determining the best interests of the child. I might just say here that we recognise that when separation occurs, somebody might hit somebody. It's a very highly emotional time. But that's very different to somebody who started beating their wife when she was pregnant years ago. And they're two completely different kinds of violence, and the court doesn't seem to make any provision for that or investigation into that. Under the current laws, best interest of the child is never defined. Emotional and psychological well-being are not given the weight they should be. Some research indicates that witnessing abuse and violence is more damaging than having been a victim of it. The child blames themselves for not being able to protect their parent. They feel powerless and fearful of the violent parent, regardless if there is a supervisor present. Many of you here tonight are aware that there's a review of the Family Law Act underway by the present government. This is due to be handed down in December. While the men's rights groups have pitted themselves against mothers, saying that the laws were weighted against them, which was true pre-1995, I would like to ask them now to consider another approach as these laws are reviewed. To move away from advocating for fathers' rights and move towards focusing on the rights of children to be and feel safe. I put out the challenge to any of the groups represented here tonight to sit down with me and nut out how we can make the system work so that parents with abusive behaviours are encouraged by the new laws to address those behaviours. And how the family law system can better work to determine what is really happening inside a broken family unit, to determine what is really best for the child. Some of the cases recently reported defy common sense. A mother told to stop breastfeeding her baby, I think it was 8 months old, within 3 months, so that the child could spend overnights with the father. Currently, this baby is shuttling 3 hours a day, several times a week, so the father has access. How can this in any way be considered in the best interest of the child? A child ordered to live with his stripper mother and partner, who held the record for the most child porn ever found on an Australian adult's computer. A family court judge who said that because the child was young, if sexual abuse had occurred, it wouldn't affect them. The level of ignorance is astounding. We have parents who, on one of our YouTube videos, which some of you may or may not have seen, we had a mother describing how her small daughter was forced by the court to visit her father in jail after he had attempted to murder the mother in the most horrible way. There are serious problems with these current laws, the judges and family court experts. We seek to have them redressed. We need to work as a united front of mothers and fathers in changing these laws so that all our children have their best chance in life to be and always feel safe. I think there are some points that I've heard here tonight that I've just jotted down and others that I've spoken to the Richard Hillman Foundation, which is a men's rights group in Adelaide, which is the only men's rights group which has engaged with us, and I commend them for that. And one of the things on their agenda was lie detector tests. So I have nothing against lie detector tests. I would support them if that's what is the bugbear, that people say false allegations. Let's get them into court as part of the process. Child support payments. Personally, I'd like to scrap them completely and make it the government just pay for whoever has the child a reasonable amount per child, so that the parents can move on in their life and have another family. Obviously, the mother is going to move on and she'll have a new partner, and she doesn't want him paying child support payments either. I think there's an argument for that. I think we all need to address the costs of the family court, that there should be limits on how much you spend. $450,000, I think someone said. We had $700,000 for one as well. It's outrageous. And I think the new laws should encourage and support and finance programs for healing for all parents who have behavioural issues. If anyone wants to talk to me about getting together to nut all these things out, I'd be very happy to do that. Thank you.
And we'll be back in just a moment with more of Barbara Biggs.
You say you want a revolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. You tell me that it's evolution. Well, you know, we all want to change the world. When you talk about destruction,
going to take questions. People who want to ask questions will stand at the microphone when they're acknowledged, come up to the mid-microphone, that one there that the lady's just tampering with, and keep your questions short, sharp, and to the point. And you'd better say which of the panel you wish to address your question to, preferably only one because of time. Yes.
Mr. Yusuf. Peter Van the World mentioned Belgium. Peter mentioned Belgium as being a better case. I've heard a lot of criticisms of our legal system and the belief that the European civil courts are a better, superior form of law. For example, Mr. Evan Wickham I've heard him speak, and I've heard him on the Philip Adams show, strong critic of our adversarial system of law. Would the European type of system, such as they have in Belgium, be fairer, not as likely to reach the 450,000 or 700,000 in cost, and would it be a better system for placing all facts on the table? For example, Barbara mentioned the girl who had scars on her back and was told to, that not to produce that in court, put it in the put it in her drawer and just leave it there. Would the European system be a better type of system? Would a lot of the problems that we have done away with if we had the fairer common system they have in Europe, the civil court system?
Well, to be quite frank with you, I'm unaware of what the European courts do or don't do, so I can't really fairly comment in that regard. But
Could you come up to the microphone, please, Mark? Some people can't
hear
you.
I'm sorry. As I was saying, I'm not too sure what the European courts do or don't do, but from my personal experience so far, having done this for a few years now, there is always going to be room, a lot of room, for improvement in the family court. That is without a doubt. The most recent changes have involved trying to get people together. In fact, before you file an application for parenting orders in the family court or the soon-to-be-scrapped Federal Magistrates Court of Australia, you have to go to a FDR mediator, which is a fancy name for a mediator who's accredited to give what we call a Section 60I certificate to show the court that you've attempted mediation. That has got its positives, it's got its negatives, but I guess it's a step in the right direction to a certain extent of trying to get people to try and resolve their matters before coming to court. Of course, having heard my colleagues tonight, one of the main problems that I have with that certificate, for example, is that if there is child abuse or domestic violence that is involved or alleged, then you have to prepare a separate affidavit to try and prove your innocence to a certain extent. So there are always going to be bits and pieces in family court, that we can improve on, if that kind of answers the question.
Thank you very much, Mark. Excellent. Next question, please. Just raise your hand, whoever it is. Yes, lady at the back. Come forward, please.
Is this Keith?
Yes.
I used to be involved with Childbirth Education Association when it came to Australia. We helped pioneer men coming into the wards and hospitals, and we got thrown out of hospitals because they didn't think men should be in their birthing centres, and we helped do that. I also was involved with a Nursing Mothers Association, and that was in the 60s, because basically I'm simple and 60 this year, and I've only got a simple answer for this. I've been a mother, and what I have found is that in nursing a child, I have found that a lot of the mothers, they just didn't know how to cuddle their children. And I found that absolutely astounding. And that has been since the 70s, that you all talk about love, love, love. You put on the television and all you see is these razor men and attacking this, attacking that, and then you've got some more transformers and you've got this, but whoever talks about cuddles? Nobody talks about cuddling that baby. I don't even hear mothers talk about cuddling their babies. But you talk about love, but no one knows how to even, what is it? It starts off from cuddling that child and loving that child. And we found that in educating women in nursing their children, breastfeeding them. And all it is cuddles and cuddles of that child to start off with. Well, maybe that's where it all stems from. I must have been living in a garden somewhere to listen to all that's happening in the courts of the men being deprived of their children and women too, and all this violence. All I'm hearing is violence. I cannot believe it, but it's cuddles. All you do is cuddle those children. Learn how to cuddle them. That's the beginning of love. If you just don't do that, well, you're not getting anywhere.
Does any member of the panel wish to take that challenge? No? Okay, we'll pass to the next question yourself, yes.
Okay, good. I think Colin's great. I've got two boys and I love it. I love dearly, and I've been processed by this horrible family law system the past 18 months, and I'm in a situation of being a fairly high income earner. I've lost everything, okay? $250,000 plus in legal fees. Absolutely abhorrent how lawyers, the most inefficient, uncaring people, can create a circumstance for tearing a family apart, okay? We talk about false allegations, there is a lot of that. Never a violent person. I actually lived in an abusive relationship. I've been assaulted. Once again, being a male, you never can take it on the chin. You're not used to going to the police or something like that, if that happens. That's engendered from birth. When we're young, we take it on the chin as a male. This is it's a very serious problem. I think a lot of what we face with today, with society, this whole system, we need to take child custody primarily out of the courts and out of the adversarial system, because lawyers are no better placed than anybody else to make decisions about children and how they should be parented. Okay, and you know, it is so wrong. And Barbara was talking about before repealing some amendments back about false allegations in the family court. Well, yes, there are special provisions in there, but in a court, this is the only court in the world that you can actually lie under oath with impunity.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah.
And it's wrong, you know, and officers of the court, so-called lawyers, encourage that. You go to any book on Amazon or whatever, you will find books on how to set yourself up for the upper hand in divorce proceedings, okay? And it is wrong. The lawyers make the money. In fact, Alec Baldwin's book, which is, you know, he was sensationalised for what he did to his child, which is totally wrong, and I was very much, I hated when I saw that, but actually reading that book and hearing about his insight to the legal industry and how it rips apart people, creates a contest where the children are the booty prize. There's monetary and financial reward for women to hold custody. There's also child support reward to hold custody. We need to stop that. We need to have a level playing field. And I applaud what Barbara said before about perhaps making child support go away. I think we have a fairer system here in Australia. But we need to take children's cases out of the court. And just to finish up, yes, there is a certificate process, but that can be easily manipulated. If one party does not want to turn up to mediation, the other party will turn up and they'll be granted a certificate that they fail to complete mediation. There's no compulsion on that other party to actually turn up. That is wrong. So it's an absolute joke. Okay, so I think we need to go back to the basics, educating parents, certainly to, if we can maintain our relationships, our marriages, our families, or in the alternative, proper mediation before you actually engage a lawyer, because they are not going to help you. They're not going to help our children. And I believe the Darcy Freeman case primarily was caused as a result of the adversarial process. It was abhorrent what actually happened.
Excuse me, I wonder if I could ask from now on that if people want to say something that they don't understand.
Yes, I know you're making a statement, that's right. Is there any member of the panel that you wish to address your statement to specifically?
Well, I think really for everyone, how can we make it better for children? How can we make it better for parents, people going through the process? What checks and balances need to be put in place? We have no consumer protection for people who enter into family law. And what result? All we're talking about is dividing up some assets, and we're looking at how we parent our children. Up until separation, people got on very well with their children in the majority of cases. There was no history of violence in the majority of cases, except once we get the lawyers involved, that's when the false allegations come out, the intervention orders and so forth. So what I'm saying is that we need to go back to basics and say, what is causing these problems, okay? Is it the right process?
Thank you. Okay, I think we will take the next question now, and that's yourself, sir.
What was the question?
This is a statement, but it's also, I'll end with a question. It was probably directed towards Barbara. In January 2008, I was accused of very serious, very serious allegations were made against me about my then 3.5-year-old child. I knew there was absolutely no foundation to the allegations. I had no choice but to take my wife to court. It was the last place I ever expected to be. in my affidavit, I expressed very serious concerns about the welfare of my child. The court ordered that my child would stay with his mother pending a psychiatric investigation, and I was allowed to have supervised contact with my child. I found that incredibly humiliating, and I knew that the wrong decision was being made. I made an objection, but you know, I had to abide by the judge's decision, obviously. Within 3 months, my wife had abducted the child out of Australia. They've since disappeared without trace. It's 14 months. Excuse me, I get a bit emotional. It's been 14 months. Barbara, you said that you were asking men and men's groups to meet with you and to work with you. I would dearly love to do that. Several months ago, I reached out to women's groups around the world to try and get some help. Not one helped. Excuse me. Not one of them helped. And for the next 2 months, I was the subject of quite a sustained and vicious attack by the women's groups around the world. So the best interest of my child is not being served by anyone. And I would like to now make a public request for you to follow up on your offer for people to work with you. I'm desperately trying to work with women's groups around the world, men's groups, any group, to help find this child and his mother who needs help. But I simply cannot get it. And I'm heartened to hear that you want to work with me, because I don't believe in this gender divide. I think it's rubbish, I think it's a fabrication. It's all about the children. But I cannot convince certain elements within our society that this particular child is at a very, very high level of risk. The men are helping, but I can't get the women to help. So if your offer is genuine, I'd like to meet with you.
You want me to come to my...
Thank you.
I think I'm familiar with your case. Of course, I won't say any more about it, but... I think child sexual abuse cases should be in a separate area, completely separate area, because they are particular and they require specialised expertise, and psychiatrists in general don't have that expertise. They're not trained to deal with that. In fact, most counsellors, psychologists and psychiatrists aren't. You need years of training in sexual abuse, rape crisis, whatever. Yes, I can see... I know there are many women's groups who are very anti-male, and I don't think that's equally unhelpful as, you know, men's groups being anti-female. There are cases where children have been abducted overseas, and the media has been, the names have been identified, the family court has lifted the gagging laws in order to find the child. The media then is enlisted to help find the child, but the media are never allowed to let the public know what the allegation is. And so everybody feels that the person who's abducted the child is in the wrong. However, the allegations are there for a reason. Now, there might be some misunderstanding, but they also might be true. We don't know. We're not qualified to say. You don't abduct a child unless you have very grave concerns about that child. We have a mother, one of our YouTube mothers, in fact, who abducted her child to Perth because the court awarded unsupervised access to a man who had 2 child sex convictions. And just last week in Adelaide, a man who had a child sex conviction and was awaiting sentencing was given full custody of his child. This particular mother was found after 3 months and returned to Adelaide. And the 4-year-old child was given full custody to the alleged perpetrator, who had full-blown AIDS. and that child is now 13 and has run away and has scars all up her arms from self-harming and had a suicide attempt and has now told everybody that she's been sexually and physically abused for the last 9 years. And she's never had a private conversation with her mother since she was 4 years old because of supervised access. So that mother took that chance to abduct the child because she felt she was protecting it. In the end, of course, it backfired, and that child lost any protection that it was ever going to get. All I can say is that I think child sexual abuse is a very particular allegation, and it needs very... it needs to be dealt with by professionals who have a lot of experience in that area, not by as a family court psychiatrist expert who sees the child once and makes a determination on that. It's just ridiculous to think that that can be, the truth can be got at in that way.
You didn't answer the question.
Sorry, what was the question?
I would like to work with you.
Oh, yes, well... Yes, definitely.
Very, very important question of this gentleman. You gave us a lecture about that again. You should say, yes, I help you, you don't help. But don't...
Yes, I would... I thought... Yes, well...
Thank you very much, Ryan.
What I would like to do is link with you, because you're the only person from the mother's movement.
Well, I'm not from the mother's movement, actually.
Well, whatever. You're the only person that I've been able to actually engage with on this issue. Not one single person who purports to, to be a female, to purports to be looking after the vested interests of the child in this case.
Well, perhaps we could have a chat afterwards.
But that would be great. That's all I'm
asking.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you.
And that was the second part of our broadcast of last week's forum at Parliament House in Sydney. And we'll be back after this short break with Part 3.
Because of fiscal problems, we can only take 3 more questions. I'm sorry about that, but I've been constrained by parliamentary rules here. We have to be right out of the building by 9. 3 more questions. That is it. And you have my apologies from 3 people who have said nothing. Who might they be? 1, 2, 3. That's it. Yes, sir, to them. Okay. Yes. Thank you, sir. Yes.
Hi, I'm Peter Fulton. Mark, I want to address a question to you. You identified some areas in the law that seem to give it built to the law when executing judgments. Can you see any solutions that would balance family law? There's one thing that I found common from every speaker up here, and that is Australian family law doesn't work.
Peter, I don't know if family law doesn't work. As I said previously, I think there are a lot of reforms that need to be made, and I do agree with one comment that was made earlier, and that is to try and keep the problem within the family. That's easier said than done. It might be a cop-out. People might consider that a cop-out. But from a personal perspective, for example, I come from a background, a nationality, a religion, and culture, most definitely, that tells us that problems within the family home remain within the family home and you don't contact the police. Rightly or wrongly, that's the way that it is. Now, unfortunately, as a family lawyer, I get new client inquiries, for example, all the time, and I will find the person on the other end of the phone saying, well, he yelled at me, or she yelled at me, for that matter. So I call the police. As a professional, as a person to whom people are coming for advice, I can only give them my legal advice. And I say, you've done the right thing. You had a reasonable fear that this person was intimidating, so you've done the right thing. You've contacted the police. Personally, though, I'd like to jump through the phone and strangle them and say, why? What do you think you're going to achieve? So in terms of family law becoming a better system, if I can call it that, there is most definitely, I think, a movement of trying to encourage people to stop coming to court. I think a greater push in terms of education, perhaps more counselling during that period of the problem starting before it gets to a separation. I don't know how, I don't know where the funds are going to really come from, but my own personal perspective is try and resolve it before you come to court. And we as a society, I believe, we need to do that. And there was a comment in regards to lawyers being, you know, the evildoers of this world. I'd be lying to you and doing a great injustice to the frankness that my colleagues tonight have exhibited to you to say that there aren't bad family lawyers. There are some terrible family lawyers, okay? Let's be honest. I know as soon as I get an introductory letter from the other side, for example, I know if that person I'm going to be able to work with them or not. And I know what sort of attitude that particular firm will take. And it's terrible knowing that this is going to be a long, drawn, fought-out battle. And I've said that to my clients from day one. Okay. Are lawyers to blame? Some of them are. Family law system, is that to blame? Most definitely. As to whether there's a foolproof solution to it, I don't think there really is. Because you're involving someone, a third party, whether it be the court or a lawyer or whoever it might be, who doesn't know you from a bar of soap. And you're inviting them to come and deal with your matter, which is the most highly personal of matters, and that is the family unit.
Sir?
I'll try and be real quick if I can. Mine's for Barbara. Also for the lady down the back, that I actually teach and have for many years children that are deemed at risk, in most case family scenarios. And my children are amazed by a poster that the Fatherhood Foundation brought out, which is 100 Ways to Praise a Child. When I read that to the classes, they are just in awe of those lovely words that replace the F and the C word, which they quite usually when they first get into knowing what they mean for. But anyway, Barbara, I wanted to say that this gentleman stood up before he said men's groups. There's a few tags that are thrown at men's organisations, and it's men's rights. And I said that when you said that, that just personally was abrasive to me, because I've worked in dads in distress for many years now. And I think we need to change that wording, It's a men's support group. I don't think any of the guys, and I work in one of the largest DIDS organisations, refer to ourselves as men's rights. It's something that permeates through the media. Mm-hmm. And there's one point in what you said before. You mentioned a figure that I found, I agree with so much that you said, and I want to chin wave with you later, and I might be sitting next to this guy in your forums if you'd have me. But you mentioned that 30% of the mothers are doing the sexual interference, sexual, somebody help me out with the term, sexual abuse, wonderful. And then you went on to say 50% of men. Now, what is the breakup between the biological father in that 77%? Yeah. I think you said it was like tenfold the men were doing this. What is the breakup between that being the biological father, the new man on the scene, and mental illness for the man?
I don't recall saying 50% or
30%.
Yeah, 30% women definitely. I don't recall saying 50. Well, it must be 70.
30% for men.
Yes, I mean, you know.
The definition I want to hear here is.
Yes, I understood the question. I don't believe there's been any research around that. I haven't seen any. That's not to say it's not there, but I do know that. Many of them are fathers, biological fathers. Many are boyfriends of mothers or new stepfathers. I guess that's what you're getting at. But I'm very involved with a program that's just been defunded in Perth called Safe Care, and it's a treatment program for child sexual offenders, and it treats the whole family. And it's a very successful program. It's got a recidivism rate of 2%. And I will ask the woman who runs that program what percentage of the 700 men who've... I think she's only had 10 women in the time she's been there, but that's not necessarily indicative of the level of female abuse. I know when people try to get help for female abuse, they're not believed. There is a study by Professor Freda Briggs of 198 men in prison who admitted to being sexually abused. 27 of them tried to report their sexual abuse by a female, and only one was successful. I think the rate was 50% female offenders in those particular cases, because that was a particular population prison sample, so they're not necessarily representative of the whole sample. But fathers do sexually abuse their daughters and sons. And the risk factor is that 92% of child sexual abusers were themselves abused as a child. So if you have been abused as a child, there's a much greater chance that you will abuse your own child. Now, I don't think people who sexually abuse their children or anyone else's children are monsters. I think they're very damaged and they can get help, and their behaviour can be changed. This program has a recidivism rate of 2%, so people need help, and we need to stop hating those people and encourage them to actually seek help in some way.
Barbara, just before you go, I've taken personal offence to something you've just said there, and you say fathers abuse their children.
And mothers.
No. You generalised that all fathers abuse their children.
No, I didn't say all. I said...
You didn't say...
I said people who sexually abuse their children, some of them are fathers and some of them are mothers.
I didn't hear that.
Yeah, she did.
Yeah, obviously not all fathers sexually abuse their children. That would be absurd to think that.
You didn't say that, did you?
No, no,
I didn't think you did either. Right, last question, sir.
Yes, this is for Barbara. You made some sweeping statements about violence. This is a yes or no question, so I don't want a big speech on it. Do women commit domestic violence?
Of course they do.
Right, that's the first thing. You said the media, we're in a media-friendly environment for men's groups, which I haven't seen that myself, and I read the paper as much as anyone else. Can you justify that answer?
Yes, I can. Because there has not been a consistent, cohesive group of people representing women's rights. And I heard he mentioned at least half a dozen male support groups. I don't know of any female support groups like that, so they're simply not quoted, because there isn't a counter to the Shared Parenting Council, who's almost always quoted. You've done a great job there. Who's the Shared Parenting Council? Yeah, you've done a great job there, because they always quote you, but they very rarely give a counter comment.
All right. Well, there's no women's groups. How come Violence Against Women Australia says no? Over $20 million is dedicated to that cause.
42, actually.
42 million, is it? If there's no women's groups, how could that money be dispersed?
There is the Office of Women, and there isn't an Office of Men. The reason it's an Office of Women is because such a large percentage of politicians are men, such a large percentage of people in public life and running public companies are men, and the Office of Women was created to redress that imbalance.
You also said that there were children that were forced to go with an abusive parent, and I don't even know if that's the case, but where are your statistics from that says they are forced to go with?
Well, from our membership.
What's your membership made up of?
We have men and women in our group, and if you have seen your father, as I mentioned in that case, spit on, drag around by the hair and kick with steel-toed boots, would you be happy to go and sit in a room for an hour with someone who you'd seen do that to your mother? I don't think so.
I would not be happy if I saw my father. It happened to my father.
No, exactly. No, of course. So in either case, the child is forced to sit in that room. They don't go willingly. And even if they're not screaming, it's not a good idea to have a child have access with a violent parent, whether that's a mother or a father. It's not a good idea that that parent does not address that behaviour, whether it's of either gender.
Could you tell me, how many make up your group to come up with your statistics?
Okay, which statistics are they?
The one you said about that calls to go with their...
I don't think that's a useful question. I don't know that there's been any research on forced to go, but I think the common sense of having a child sit in a room with a violent parent, it just doesn't make sense. If they need supervised contact, they should be addressing their behaviour.
Thank you, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Barbara. And now, Marika Alida handles public relations for the Roundtable Forum, and I'd like to invite Marika to present the vote of thanks for this evening's forum. Welcome, Marika.
I'd like to just change the atmosphere, if I could, for a moment. At Oxford University, Magdalen College, a young Oscar Wilde said to his friends, "Ah, would that I could live up to my blue china." Now, the blue china in the Jubilee Room possibly is the wonderful illustrated history of Australia we see around the room, and the, above all, the mosaic of, well, it's pretty badly lit tonight, isn't it? But the mosaic of colour that is normally there is stained glass. So I wonder if you would agree with me that this evening all five speakers have more than lived up to their blue china this evening. I think so, and I think you would agree with me this evening. It is always said that beautiful surroundings inspire one to lift one's standard in whatever it is one does. First of all, may I just now turn to the speakers. Mr. Mark Youssef, thank you. I asked you perhaps to give us a bit of an idea of the lay of the land legally. And this is a difficult thing to do because you are up against people who are perhaps speaking with a more impassioned background. But you did extremely well. It was well informed. You gave us an idea of the rights, the responsibilities of both parents, statistics we could relate to, And I thank you very much for that. I think you also have an interest in educating children in law. I think you do a lot of work in that. Is that correct?
A little bit here and there.
Yes, I understand that. And a lot of voluntary work as well. And I think we all should be made aware of that. Thank you very much, Mr.
Thank
Youssef.
You.
We have our two speakers. We have Mr. John Stapleton, Mr. Peter van der Voorde. Thank you both very much. John, I believe you're the founder of Dads on the Air. Ladies and gentlemen, do look at that one time, dadsontheair.net. It has wonderful articles, irrespective of what direction you come from. And I think, as with most things, our judgments are based on our experiences in life. And because they're different, our judgments have to be different. But they're equally valid. And there are some wonderful articles on that. Thank you very much, and for your talk. We felt the frustration, and we felt the suffering. And I think it was not just of yourself, but you must have had many experiences of others, and that came through in your talk, and we respect that and we appreciate it. Thank you, John. Peter, I think you gave a very good all-round talk. I felt it was very balanced. I think we all related to it very well. Thank you for that. Particularly, I think you produce and direct Dads on the Air. Is that correct? And there are a lot of articles that you write as well that I really enjoyed reading. Is that correct, John? All right. Peter, I realise you also have a background in music, and it's I think it'd be an idea for some of you now again to look at the lyrics of some of the work that Peter has been mentioned as having written an album that he has of Our Stolen Children. I really enjoyed those lyrics. Thank you, Peter. Mr. Warwick Marsh, you came late, but you were not the least, and we enjoyed you extremely much. You have a wonderful combination of pathos, of music, and of genuine information and experience. I think you've been probably through hell and back in the public arena since last November. So I particularly, I think on behalf of all of us, congratulate you on coming this evening and lifting our spirits with your music and your wonderful talk. We all enjoyed it. Thank you very much. Barbara, I believe it was 3 o'clock, 2:50, when we finally got to the point where you agreed to come as our replacement speaker. And if you consider that to be a speech that is made in a short period of time, then what a wonderful job. You particularly were a rose among thorns this evening. I hope they were. Oh, they weren't very prickly thorns, Mark. and I hope you didn't find them so. But you did handle some very prickly questions. And I understand that it is difficult, because I do, and I think all of you realise, that the majority of you are men. And I do understand also, even though I did ask you all to please make it a statement or not a question, that we're dealing with people that have, as I've said before, you lose a child, it is a part of yourself, and that jigsaw of yourself that is remaining can never be put together again, it's never whole. So I do understand there is a great deal on your hearts that you want to say. It was only that we had a time restriction. Please forgive me, it wasn't out of not feeling for what you were saying. And Barbara, you handled the questions very well. I do understand that it's difficult, and particularly in your case, I just wanted to quote a couple of things you said, because they remained with me, and I thought it was a good way to close that as I'm speaking to you. You talked about the rights of children to feel and be safe, and you talked about the need to work as a united front. So perhaps I could take that from your talk. Thank you very much, Barbara, from all of us. To the audience, who came out on a wet night, and the winter's evening, too bad, Bob, you can wave as much as you like, who came out on a wet evening, thank you very much, because our democracy teeters on a very small and undervalued fulcrum called good manners. And look, you did show that this evening under a lot of pressure, emotional pressure. Thank you very much. If you don't have one, please take a flyer on your way out. And on behalf of the Fellowship of the Round Table, I wish you good night. Have a safe trip home. Thank you very much.
And that was part three of the fascinating forum that was held last week at Parliament House in Sydney by the Fellowship of the Round Table. As I'm sure you'll all agree, it was a fascinating forum with some very interesting material and questions, and very good to hear the words of Barbara Biggs from her own mouth. As an example of the protests that Ms. Biggs has been organising, a group of so-called blood-stained and bandaged mothers paraded outside New South Wales Parliament House in Sydney last week, calling on the family court to stop ordering children to see abusive parents. With arms in fake slings, artificially bruised faces and broken dolls in prams, about 30 mums took part in the bandage parade, hoping to highlight the danger of giving unsupervised custody of children to abusive parents after separation. Barbara Biggs said, "We have a systemic failure when more than 15,000 Australian children are ordered into ongoing contact with parents the court itself has deemed violent and abusive. This has happened because of hastily written shared parenting laws and the family court turning a blind eye to abuse when it comes to its duty of care for Australian children." Well, we at Dads on the Air would absolutely agree that no children should be given contact with parents who are abusive to children. That's, that's without doubt, and we would be very supportive. Unfortunately, it looks like the current federal government may throw the baby out with the bathwater, so to speak, and may actually turn back the good points of the modest reforms that the Howard government introduced, which would mean that all of the great advantages to children and to mums and dads of shared parenting after divorce would be lost. Next week on Dads on the Air, the case for shared parenting, with special guests Maurice Vellacott, who's a Canadian MP who is introducing shared parenting legislation into the Canadian Parliament. We also have Michael Green, QC, author of the book Shared Parenting. We have Sue Price from the Men's Rights Agency, one of the country's staunchest defenders of children and their fathers. And we also have on the show an Australian father who was jailed for a month for inadvertently playing golf next to a sporting field where his son, unbeknownst to him, was playing soccer. You can find us at dadsontheair.net.
We're dads on the air. We're dads on the air.